Hey folks, if you're in Austin and you're looking for some live music in the live music capital of the world, why not check out 2013-2014 Austin Chronicle Music Poll winner for Best All Ages Venue, Best Sounding Venue, and Best Venue, Strange Brew Lounge Side. Simply go to strangebrewlounge.com, look on their calendar, and find out what's going on. From Joey Lee to Christopher Cross, Steve Pultz, to today's guest, Stephen Doster, who's having a record release there Saturday, February 14th. Go to Strange Brew Lounge Side for yourself and see why Austin's best venue has to offer. strangebrewlounge.com. Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time. How did I get here? And now here is your host, Tommy Bowdy.
When we talked,
all right. Hello, I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I have a fantastic show for you today. I am catching up with a dear old friend of mine, Stephen Doster. He just put out an album called Arizona. It is absolutely fantastic. And he has a record release show this Saturday, February 14th at 9:30 at Strange Brew Lounge Side in Austin, Texas. Bound to be a great show. I wish I was going to be in town for it, but I suggest that you go to it. So yeah, Stephen and I have been friends for a long, long time. And he came by the other day and we sat down and had a long conversation about how he got here. And also his new album, Arizona, which is a fantastic and beautiful album. He doesn't do a lot of solo albums because he's constantly producing records for other people. He's produced like over 70 records. And I got the chance to co-produce a record with him once, I think almost like 8 or 9 years ago. It was fantastic. We did a record for an artist named Stephanie Fix, but it was a great experience working with Stephen. It's always great. I've gotten to play with him over the years, over the last like 20-something years, 23 years. We've gotten to play a lot of shows together. I've gotten to be on stage with him. He's filled in on guitar for my bands when Mr. Rocket Baby split up. He played with me and my friend Anar and Kevin Pearson, did a few shows with us then. I spent a lot of time doing acoustic shows with him in the 90s, in between stuff. Always having a great time, man. Steven is a great, fantastic guy with a great story, and I love him. So I'm glad that he was able to come by and talk to me. I love his album, Arizona. I love his last album, Rosebud. As I said, he doesn't get to put out a lot of albums. He just toured in England. And now he will be doing some shows in support of this album after the February 14th release at Strange Brew. So get on out there. Check him out if you are in Austin. If you're not in Austin, look him up. His music's out there. It's on the iTunes. You can go to stephendoster.com, find out if he's coming to a town near you or whatnot. Okay? Fantastic conversation with Stephen Doster coming up. What was I going to tell you about me? What's going on with me this weekend? I was off from Skyrocket. Didn't do much. Went on a Friday time with my friend Chris and Lisa. I went as a third wheel, I guess, hanging out with them. That was fun. We went to a lot of different places, ate a lot of different food, had a few drinks, came in, worked on some stuff. I've been booking South by Southwest, and that honestly takes up a lot of time. I have to listen to a lot of bands. I really choose them. I don't just pick bands because they're coming. I pick because I want to talk to them. I think their music's interesting, or I read something about them that's interesting. So basically, yeah, I go through that whole thing and I finish this weekend. So I'm done. I'm absolutely done. Yesterday, I did not enjoy the Grammys as I fell asleep at the beginning of it. So missed it. Was going to live tweet some stuff. I kept on waking up throughout it, and I woke up and saw this girl, Brooke Axtell, that I knew. She used to do photos with my wife back in, you know, the early 2000s. Very weird. It was really intense. Like, she was talking about some very intense stuff, like domestic abuse and stuff. It was great. Great to see her on that platform, but very intense to wake up from sleeping and that's on the TV. And you're like, wait, I know that girl. Whoa, shit, man, this is heavy. Is this still the Grammys? Like, I woke up to it. I'm not saying it didn't belong there. I'm just saying it was weird to wake up to. Anyway, so yeah. Congratulations to her on getting out there and getting her message out there and getting it out to everyone. Skyrocket will be in San Antonio at the Aztec Theater this Friday. If you are around Friday the 13th, come on out to the Aztec Theater in San Antonio. We will be there jamming out and rocking out for you, the people. All right? I hope you guys all are having a great time. Let's get to this conversation with Stephen Doster. I absolutely love this guy. It's a long conversation, so I'll make my intro short. All right? Let's talk to Stephen Doster. Let's get down. Yeah, it's been a long time. I was thinking about all the stuff we did together, playing at Babe's.
God,
it slips the mind, but there was like every Wednesday for like a few months.
We did that
together.
We did. It was amazing. And when I think about all that stuff, it's never ending for me at this point in my life.
Is it good? You can turn them up or down. You're in two.
Yeah, it sounds good like this. Reminiscing, you know, and looking back, I find myself talking to people and not realizing, for instance, a subject will come up, a certain musician, and I'll go, yeah, I know them, I played with them, and you know, it'll go on, and after a while, it gets really annoying, I think,
yeah,
to people,
because
you keep, oh, yeah, really? And I was recently had a very great experience of touring the UK behind this new record, Arizona.
Yeah.
And I went with my friend Bob Cheevers, and Bob, uh-huh. Bob's a great friend and a great artist. I produced a record for him called Tall Texas Tales about 3 or 4 years ago, and we became very close, which is you need to be if you're going to sit in a car with somebody for 6 weeks and drive up and down those slight little narrow roads. And we were talking to people quite a bit and playing a lot of shows. We played almost every night and talking to the, I hadn't been back to England. I kind of grew up there. I moved there when I was 1 year old. And so I realized it had been decades since I'd been back.
Yeah.
Have you been recently?
No, not recently.
Yeah.
Not since the 90s.
Yeah. The dreaded 90s. I went to a basketball game the other night, and that was their theme. It was 90s night, and I was going, what does that mean? I mean, you know, the only thing I could even think of was Kurt Cobain.
Yeah, it's like the first thing that comes to mind.
Yeah, it's like Kurt, and then other images that aren't so pleasant come to mind after it.
Yeah. Hey, so you were saying something in the kitchen, and I stopped you so we could start doing this, but you were saying that...
Oh, moving out to Blanco.
Yes, moving out to Blanco.
Well, it was, I guess it was, you know, over 30, pushing 40 years in town of playing. And the last 25 of that, my wife, Melinda, and I were married in 1990.
Yeah.
And so for, it'll be at the end of this year, 25 years we've been married, and I've known her for double that.
Wow.
I've known her, and I met each other as children in San Antonio. But my son was born a day after our first anniversary, September 24th. And what happens, so he grew up in Austin and went off to college.
Yeah.
And I woke up one day and realized, well, we don't really have to stay here. The whole reason that we were staying in the neighborhood we were was because it was a great school district for him and where he had grown up and where he was comfortable. And also we were comfortable, too. We lived in Zilker area and could walk to the park. But I kept having a dream every night. I'd come home from a session. And during this period of time, I had strived really hard to refinance my home. And it was really difficult for a self-employed person to do. And it took a lot out of me to do it. I kept having to pull rabbits out of the hat to do it. But a lot of sessions, a lot of gigs, and night after night. And I started having a dream. And it was a recurring dream. Most of my dreams don't recur. I have pretty vivid dreams, but the main thing I remembered about this dream was the colors and the color of the water. And I was on a river And I could see it very succinctly. And I would ask the person, whoever was with me, where are we? And they would say, in one of the dreams, I remember a person saying we were in Nebraska. And I said, this doesn't look like Nebraska. I've been there. And we went around a bend in this boat, and all of a sudden it got really beautiful, almost psychedelic, like a Wizard of Oz, but pretty, and like it was all painted. And when I, during this period of time, when I first started considering maybe I, it was a time to get out of Austin proper, I went there, and that it was literally that river was
in Blanco.
In Blanco, and I live across the street from it now, and I see it from my window.
Oh, wow.
And it's pretty bizarre to because it was the color of it, which is I couldn't figure out what the color was because it's I've decided on teal, that it's the color of teal.
Is that like a pink or like
no, it's
tan?
No, it's green and blue.
Oh, okay.
And it's a really beautiful blend of the two.
All right.
And it was I know that color name a childhood friend, when he came to visit, that's what he called it. And then I remembered the color from another circumstance. But I had a shirt that was and Seth Walker, a musician, stole it from me. And he's my friend. He borrowed it, never gave it back. But it was really interesting for me in a turning point, and that was around the time I started getting into the mode to make the record Arizona. Because up until then, I'd been thinking about it and writing songs, but making a record is a big investment in many ways, not just financial. I'm a co-owner of a really wonderful studio called EAR, acronym for East Austin Recording. We got lucky with the name, right?
Yeah.
And thanks largely to my colleague who runs it, was James Stevens.
And he worked on the album too, right?
He did. Okay. And he worked in tandem with me on the record very closely. Our roles oftentimes blur into one another's, you know, whereas he'll be credited as mixing. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I have a very involved in that. Working on records, I'll be credited as a producer, and he has lots of input and creative input. James and I work together as a team. Steve Albini, I think.
Albini,
yeah. If you pronounce it correctly, unlike me. Should you want to pronounce it correctly, always would, you know, build himself a certain way, and I think that's the way James would build himself. But how I got involved with him, because I was producing a lot, I fell into it largely from the first time I went to a major recording studio, which was in Macon, Georgia, when I had come back from living in Europe, and I'd come back from England to Austin, from London to Austin in the mid-70s, and got involved with a musician named Tommy Talton, who played when Dwayne Allman died. He kind of took.
Wait. So you were living in London, and then you moved to Austin in the mid-70s.
Yes.
What? Why?
Well, my.
Why Austin?
I had last lived in the United States in San Antonio,
uh-huh.
And it was a great place to be in the '60s. We had moved from Abilene, Texas,
right,
where I got my first band when I was in the fifth grade. And a lot of musicians from there, Steve Barber,
uh-huh.
Stephen Barber and Kyle Brock, and a lot of people from the Lubbock and Abilene area. And so I moved to San Antonio, and which is when I lived across the street from my now wife, Melinda, in 1966.
Jesus.
And basically what happened, my mother was very, very ill, and she passed away during that time. And I was already very, very much into music. That's all I kind of thought about
all the time.
It was pretty much night and day. And it pushed me even farther into it and gave more of a purpose to it. And we were really blessed at that time because there were a lot of bands coming to San Antonio. So I got to see everybody. And I was a little kid and pretty much was able to go to all these concerts. I mean, I saw the Animals was the first one.
Wow.
The first two concerts I saw were the Animals. And Eric Burdon was unreal. And I hear he still is. I just missed him when he was here in Austin. But I saw a lot of bands. I would end up seeing Hendrix, Birds, Jefferson Airplane, Grateful Dead, John Mayhall, lots of great groups.
Who are you going with to these concerts, and how old were you?
I was very, very young, and too young to be going to the concerts. A story I like the best is when I found out Blind Faith was coming, and I was about 13, and I didn't have anyone to take me, so I just kind of made up something. And kind of snuck out, I guess you could.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I go to the Blind Faith concert, and I'm in the balcony, and I realize two of my favorite bands were Cream and Traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, well,
here it
is.
Yeah.
So together,
it's all happening at once.
It's all happening on one stage at the same time. And I got an impulsive reaction. I'd seen some idiot at another concert go drop down from the balcony to the back of the stage, and I didn't really give much thought to it. I was possessed, and I went to the back of the stage, and Free had opened up the show with Paul Rodgers, and I'd never heard him before. He was unbelievable. And then Delaney and Bonnie played. And so this 13-year-old kid goes and he drops off the back of the balcony to the stage immediately. This huge policeman, and he's big Texas cop, grabs me and, "You're out of here," and grabs me and pulls me. I go, "Oh, great. My favorite band's getting ready to come on."
Yeah.
And I'm getting tossed.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the same time he grabs one arm, this woman grabs another arm. And she goes, "He's with us," with a decided British accent. And I went, "Yeah, I'm with them," and he goes, "You can't be dropping off there," and she wouldn't let go of me, and he got into kind of an argument with the lady, and the lady won, and I turned around, and I was a little guy, and I looked up at her, and I said, "Thank you so much, they're my favorite band," and she goes, "They're my favorite band as well, love," and it was Ginger Baker's wife, and she took me on stage and sat me right next to Ginger to watch him play. There's a famous photograph of that concert where he's got his hands in the air while he's playing a bass solo, a drum solo,
yeah, yeah.
On his double bass drums.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he's got his hands up. And what they don't show in the picture is he's pretty much throwing up the whole concert into a bucket because of his heroin addiction at the time, I believe. But and it was pretty incredible to be standing there. And Steve Winwood came out and he was playing his Powder Blue Explorer, and Eric Clapton. It was kind of surreal, but that's the kind of youth I had. And,
wow!
And so that explains a lot.
So did you like take the bus or something?
How I got there is still, and how I got home was even yeah. more amazing because it was very far. It was downtown in the Hemisphere Arena.
Yeah.
Sometimes we would get dropped off. I might have gotten dropped off by my family. My family was very supportive of music.
We had, right.
They knew, and also it was a painful, period of time with my mother being gone. So they were probably more prone to support that. My siblings and such. And my father, I would never really realize it until many years later. When I was a dad myself, that he was going through probably
as you imagine
harder times. He basically had lost his wife and his father and his brother within a short period of time, and so it was an interesting time, and it would end up a few years after that. We got the opportunity to go back to Europe, where I had spent a lot of my youth. And because of his job, he worked for the government. And I was born in Corpus Christi, Texas. But we moved to England before my second birthday, when I was a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
From England to France. And my mother, who was an avid antique collector, would drag us around everywhere. So I was pretty used to Europe as a young kid. But I felt displaced. And I was when I found out we were coming back to America, I had already begun elementary school in France. I was excited about it because bicycles and baseball,
right,
and music and things like that, especially in France, I didn't see any of that. And so we moved back to from France to Abilene, and there's a song on my first solo record called Rosebud. The song's called Sleepwalking.
Oh, yeah, one of my favorite songs.
And it's about that experience, about I remember the day we came to town. My mother cried, and the way she was carrying on, I thought someone had died. We were driving into the town in this little French car, and after, you know, maybe the previous weekend we'd been at the Louvre or something like this. And
now you're driving into Abilene.
Abilene, and it's flat, and it was.
And it was the 60s, too, right?
It was the 60s.
So it was even more Abilene than you can imagine.
Yeah, even more Abilene. I think it might be quite the same, you know. I remember at that time was the I even reference them in the song, but Beach Boys would play into my consciousness quite a bit. I remember them a lot. I remember hearing I had a wonderful story that was my favorite story with my friend James Honeyman Scott from the Pretenders, who would end up playing a big part in my life. He would ask me to repeat this story, but I was a young kid and living in Abilene, and the California Girls was a hit, and that song and Good Vibrations were big songs that kind of changed me. I was at that time, you know, becoming more of a Beatles fan day by, you know, year by year. When they first came out, I was a little bit I don't know if they've got anything on it. The Everly Brothers and Roy Orbison. You know, I thought maybe they were overhyped. You know, I was a little 7-year-old kid. Thinking, I don't know. I think they're overhyped. You know, then I heard. But the first song I heard was "I Want to Hold Your Hand," and I thought, oh, that's pretty good. But you know, when I heard "Please, Please Me," I was hooked, and then it went on from there. But I was still listening in the mid-60s, this would be 64, 65, listening to Beach Boys music. And the intro to California Girls is one of the most beautiful intros in pop music I've ever heard. I still, when I think of it, it just puts me in such a place. And then it goes after the dun 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 ba da, and it just this big build up.
Yeah.
And then do 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 do. These girls are hip, and they get into the thing. Well, there was a line in the song, and had the word French bikini.
Yeah.
And it was a.
I dig a French bikini.
Yeah, it was a trigger a thing in my head. That would cause a certain reaction that a young boy of that age would have when they got overly excited. And so I had a friend of mine who's had a very foxy mom. And we were in the fourth and fifth grade. And when I go to her house, she was usually vacuuming in her bathing suit. And I was going, hey, can we go over to your house? No.
He knew.
He was picking up on why I wanted to go, but so maybe it was that was triggering. But whenever I would hear that, I would have this same erection. Yes. You know, whenever I hear that verse, and so I remember going to church and being in the family, and we're driving to church, and they go, "Let's turn on the radio. Steve loves music," and I go, "Oh yeah, yeah." And I turn it on. And I go, oh no. And sure enough, I go, I'm just going to think of something different, like Johnny Unitas' haircut.
Right.
and try to avoid the inevitable. Well, the East Coast girls are hip, and it would go. And sure enough, I dig a, you know, yeah. just automatic. And so I'm kind of limping my way into church, and I remember very distinctly that, you know, the power of music And how much words can mean. And so it was a story, and I'll correlate that back into how I got back involved into the Beach Boys was later in my story. But James Honeyman Scott, it was a pretty well-known Beach Boys fanatic.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's why he kind of took me under his wing or lied to me. He gave me a test.
Yeah.
When he first met me, he was going, "Oh, Steve, don't really have a whole lot, we've got the Stones, we've got the Kinks, we've got, Beatles.
Yeah.
What do you guys have, really?" And he's giving me the business. And I said, he said, "Well, maybe Brian Wilson or something." And I said, "Listen, man, without Brian Wilson,
yeah,
it wouldn't be a Sergeant Pepper."
Right, right.
And I really gave him the business and stood up to him, and his eyes widened, and he put his arm around me. He said, "You and I are going to get on just fine. Fuck those other bands." And he goes, "The Beach Boys are God."
Yeah.
And he literally, when I would go to visit him, or we worked together quite a bit, but inevitably I'm sad that the record we intended to do didn't get made because of his passing. But he would take two speakers, instead of wearing headphones, he would hold them on his shoulders and listen to Surf's Up.
Yeah.
And just this beautiful look of bliss on it. And right before he passed, he got to be an honorary Beach Boy and got to play with them.
Oh, no shit.
And went down. They were there was a promoter from here that was friends with Jimmy and his wife, Peg, and took him to see the Beach Boys of Sands, Brian Wilson.
Right.
But Carl was there, and that was important to him, and they invited him to play with them, and so he got to play.
Right.
And he was rather thrilled about that.
That's amazing.
But how it connects in the whole story is interesting, because everything is a thread. I have first... So I start my... we end up moving from San Antonio to...
England.
Back to... at that time to Germany.
Oh, to Germany.
Where I went to high school.
Okay.
And that was a great place to be. That was in the 1970. And it was what the kind of music that I would end up playing, which was, I was an American. The German people love American and British music.
Yeah.
And so we, right off the bat, had a pretty popular band.
Yeah.
I got in a band with some older guys. And the leader of the band was maybe 20 or something. I thought he was kind of an older guy.
Right.
Maybe he was 21. And
what was your role in the band? Were you
playing
guitar?
I was a guitar player and singing, and we sang a lot of harmonies. We were
covers.
We wrote and did covers, and we did one section of bluegrass type music in the middle of the show. What had happened was, when I got over there, I got there at the end of my freshman year in high school, and so I just spent the summer going to the park playing guitar and singing. And one of the girls who was a senior and a friend of a friend, she said, "We want you to sing at the opening assembly for school that year."
Oh, that's cool.
And I thought, well, this is pretty interesting.
Way to make friends, too.
Yeah. And, so literally the first day of school, I sang in front of the whole school. And that day, about everybody and...
Real quick.
Yeah.
When you were up there singing in front of the whole school, were you like, "Huh?" Or were you like, "Yeah, this is what I'm supposed to do?" Because I've always noticed this intense calm. I mean, and I guess I didn't know you then. Mm-hmm. And in all of my years of doing stuff with you, you're just so calm when you're playing.
When I'm not, it's very unpleasant.
Well, I've always just thought, I've always admired that about you and thought, like, man, he's just like you got a very cool hand.
Well, that's really nice to say, and I don't want to tip my hand, but it was not like that for me, actually. I think I would get to that place, but any time I do anything, even to this day, I remember asking my back over there in Germany, one of the things we did, we had a drama department, and this man who was my drama coach ended up being... that if everyone has that teacher in their life that kind of mm-hmm. turns it that
yeah.
they remember that really
yeah.
did
encouraged
something for
you.
Him
yeah.
encouraged
yeah, yeah,
yeah, him.
Yeah.
It was him, His name was James Corey, and our school was being used like an experiment where you didn't have to go to class, and they were calling the principal by his first name. They were trying to be hip and gestalt and all this. And what it basically did was graduate a bunch of kids that couldn't read or write very well. it was a great experiment and a complete failure. And basically, we had a lot of kids come out of our school that were excellent frisbee throwers, and they could really roll a joint. Apart from that, it wasn't real good. And so Jim Corey he taught the accelerated English department, and he realized the importance of education, and so some of people saw him as kind of a stick in the mud or whatever. But I even then realized the discipline that he had was important, and so he would stay almost every day of his whole life that I knew him after school, and we'd be doing some sort of production, a murder mystery, what have you, and then we would put on a folk concert every year, and I got to be the star of the folk concert. But I remember telling him, and he said something similar to me. He goes, "Yeah, you handle yourself okay up there." And I said, "No, it's all the truth is I'm completely frightened to death."
Yeah.
And he said, "Worry about it when you stop being frightened, Stephen." And when he told me that, it really helped me, because he said that's just because you're concerned about it. I told him when I was an actor, I didn't get nervous at all. And I said, because I'm being someone else.
Right.
And I was going to be a character, and I just had fun with it. I got maybe a little bit of butterfly. Oh, we're getting ready to go on. But when I was doing the songs, it was very difficult to reveal, you know, yourself and your feelings. That's very nice to hear, because I've generally had a good time. I've had a couple of in the 100,000 performances, you know, that go on in a lifetime, a couple of times where I've been affected by just for brief periods of time had anxiety attacks or something like that. But I was reading about, you know, people that had that almost all the time, and I feel for them, because it's happened to me, but it's come and gone pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And it's only natural. It's like the story I love to hear about is Paul McCartney, when he was playing on Ed Sullivan, and he's behind the curtain getting ready to play, and yesterday, so he's on his own, and the stage manager is sitting there by the curtain. He goes, "Are you nervous?" He goes, "No, I feel okay." And he goes, "You ought to be. You're getting ready to play for 500 million people." They opened the
camera. Yeah.
He said he told me that right before I.
Yeah.
Because it was, you know, pretty heavy. What I think happens, I'll tell you what is for me.
That's so fucking mean to somebody.
That's cruel, isn't it? That's a
and back then it's like,
and your pants are down.
56 million people are going to watch.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
I mean,
500 million.
Yeah, 500 million
all across the world. And so I remember that. But I always found this to be true. If the bigger the crowd, the easier it was for me.
Yeah, I've had that too.
You know, because at that point it becomes a surreal thing. And it's just so same thing about. It's almost like you're not there. So one thing I tell people, younger musicians or whatever, is to make sure to have a good time and enjoy the moments, because a lot of my time when I was younger, I was always thinking of another where I was going next.
Yeah.
I'm here. This isn't it, when it was it.
Yeah.
And that is what's important.
Yeah.
And not to get too Baba Ram Doster on it, you know, be here now.
No, but yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
It's a hard thing to do. And I think once you do that for a musician, then it gets a lot better.
Yeah.
For you. Because I think most anxiety I have is, like, for instance, I'm getting ready to do a record release for this record. I'm going to be live on the radio on KUTX, and any way you cut it, you know, you're on.
And, yeah.
Especially when you're doing a live radio broadcast or something. I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. We have a lot of rehearsing we need to do. And so I think I have a fair amount of apprehension, a healthy amount.
Sure.
Maybe it's like a ball team having a proper amount of respect for the fear for their opponent.
Yeah.
You know, not that the audience is your opponent, but the it's a challenge.
Someone's got to be.
Is it
going to be the same band as on the record?
Yeah,
George
it is.
Grief, Donnie Wynn, Kevin Lovejoy.
Kevin won't be, and instead of him, I have a friend of mine who's done some sessions with me. I've worked on a couple of things named Dave Madden.
Oh yeah, Dave Madden's a good guy. Yeah, I like that guy.
He's a great guy, and he has a very disciplined method of rehearsing, and I can depend upon.
He seems like a guy who's really got it together.
He does,
like, in the world.
And I'm really looking forward to working with him. I would have loved to have Kevin. Kevin Lovejoy's contribution to the record is enormous. How I made the record was very, those guys were handpicked.
You know, Donnie never ceases to amaze me.
Yeah.
It's always like, you know.
Well, he's I'm blessed in my life. To me, one of the most important things as a musician is my relationship with the drummer. Make a joke, and I think it's stolen from a Quincy Jones line. Someone said, what does it take to be a good producer? And I said, having the phone number of a really good drummer.
Yeah.
This is a lot of the battle. And
Do you remember we did that album with...
That was the first time I worked with Donnie, with Stephanie Fix.
Yeah, with Stephanie Fix, yeah. Remember he would do like a track, and then it would be real weird, and then he'd go like, all right, give me another track, and then he'd do this other thing, and it was just like this rhythm that was just like... It's unbelievable. Like it is. There's not a lot of people like him. I mean, there's amazing dudes like what JJ played on Rosebud, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Chris Searles. Yeah.
I mean, they're all like amazing individually. Yeah. Donnie, in his uniqueness.
Yeah.
There's just this weird pulse, human pulse that goes through his music.
It's very interesting, and we just mentioned three people that have played a drum. Wise have played a big part in my life: J.J. Johnson, Chris Searles, and Donnie Wynn, and Tommy Taylor.
Oh, man, all people that I love.
And they're all so different, and they're all so talented, and they're all extremely musical.
Extremely.
People. J.J. with his soft-spoken kindness. I have a wonderful moment with him. We were doing a record of that I produced, and one of my favorite records that I've been involved in, got to work on, Stanley Smith, and it's called In the Land of Dreams. And on that record, JJ played on several cuts. I pretty much chose different artists but the drums were either Chris Searles or JJ on each track. And there's a track that they played on the radio. In fact, it was second that year to Norah Jones, who had her new big breakout and won all the awards and stuff. But it was called Sweet Butterfly. And as Stanley, I knew as a clarinetist that played with the Asylum Street Spankers. And so I did that type of stuff. But he played this gut string guitar stuff and sang in almost a Mose Allison type of character. And I was really intrigued with his own music talked for a long time about doing a record. And one of the things, ironically, I found with his music was how I do it when I produce somebody. Lots of times, especially at that period of time, we would just sit and listen to records a lot. That would be part of the process for me. I would say, I want to know what you listen to, and try to get into their head a little bit about what touches them and what speaks to them. And with him, I really got the Al Green. You know, if you know Stanley, a white guy that plays clarinet, Al Green might not be the first guy you think of.
Right.
You know, when you see him or hear him. But Sweet Butterfly was the song that was kind of a hit locally and stuff, and without trying. But I remember when we were cutting the thing, he had wanted to use his buddies that he played with all the time. And he had asked me, and I said, well, you've asked me to produce you, and I'd like you to, you know, give it a go. We recorded for an afternoon with some of the people, and these were very talented young men that he had that played with him at the time. But at this point, I really thought that JJ's playing was kind of in another realm. He had really kind of jumped the shark or whatever. And same with Chris Searles at the time. But I remember walking in and he hadn't heard the song before. And I just said, hey, you know, we hadn't said two words that day, you know, so hey, how are you? And I just walked in the room and I said, Al Jackson. And he looked at me and nodded his head a little bit. And we cut the song in one take. And it just grooved so much. And he knew exactly what I meant. And Stanley walked out of the booth, said, I've never had that experience in my life, you know, where that happened, a song of mine, where it just felt so good. And Al Jackson is the drummer for Al Green.
Yeah.
And he plays a certain way and stuff. And so just saying two words to J.J. Johnson, and he was such a consummate drummer. But at the end of the day, it's feel.
Yeah.
And there is a story I'd like to tell about what changed my life with the drums for me. And it was I wouldn't have thought it, but it was when I went to Nashville the first time. And I went up there with Nancy Griffith and Lyle Lovett. And the band was pretty all-star group. Mark O'Connor on violin, Bella Fleck on banjo, Roy Husky Jr. on bass, Kenny Malone on drums. Lyle Lovett on background vocals. It was a good, you know, pretty good band.
Good band.
Good band. And I was the music director and acoustic lead guitar player. And I played, and also Philip Donnelly, who played with the Everly Brothers on electric guitar. And I was kind of the only one who knew the changes and all that stuff. So they were calling me the music director. Well, I met this guy named Kenny Malone, the drummer on the session. And I was a new guy, and in Nashville, you don't get into sessions. The new guys don't get in. And even though the executive producers and the record company had brought me there with Nancy because we'd been playing together, and all of this was right after Honeyman Scott had died, and I was
flying low.
Well, I was just, yeah, and I was looking
lost.
Just to do something new. Yeah. I had to do something different in this, trying to get this record out that I was so close to finishing with him. It was taking a toll on my psyche, and I wanted to do something musical. And she called me, and there was an article in a paper about it one time. It's been quoted before, and she said, "Ask me if I knew anyone that played guitar like me." And I said, yeah, I do. I know this one guy. And she goes, well, you're busy, man. You know, you're not going to be able to do it. And I played with her on a bunch of her earlier records. And I said, no, I'd very much like to do that. And it was because I wanted to play acoustic guitar. I have a thing about the acoustic guitar. If you ask, you know, people that know me well, you know, what's his real instrument? You know, a lot of people would say that.
Yeah.
And because I play it a lot. And
you can get a lot out of it. That's one thing about you that I've always thought is fucking amazing.
Well, like, thanks.
You don't need a bunch of other shit. You can actually get a lot out of the acoustic guitar.
It's become my best pal. Throughout life,
yeah.
and those times as a kid, and back in Abilene when my family was going through those changes. There's no doubt about it that the acoustic guitar going into my room, and then it would be electric guitar in tandem, because I heard I was listening to records. I remember hearing Jimi Hendrix around the mid '60s, and at this time I'm listening to Beatles and Beach Boys and stuff like this, and I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I didn't know what it was.
Right.
I,
it didn't go anymore.
Yeah, it didn't. And I had no idea what he was doing. He sounded like he was from Mars to me. And so I went in my room with an acoustic guitar and was trying to find the biggest bar chords I could find. Right. Boom, blam, blam. And it didn't sound right.
Right.
And an older neighborhood friend was in the house. He said, you know, he's just playing one note. And I said, you know, you're trying to play chords. And I was trying to do the opening to Purple Haze.
Yeah.
And I said, he's just playing one note, but it's so huge. He goes, yeah, he has this thing called a fuzz box.
Yeah.
And I said, a fuzz box? He goes, yeah. And he goes, he plugs it, you plug into it, and you plug into your amplifier. And I got on my bicycle. I had a paper route at the time, so I had some money. And I drove down to Waterland Mall. And I walked to the music store, and I said, do you have a fuzz box? And they go, well, yeah, we have one. What is it? And I said, well, it's going to be mine.
It's the thing. When you give it to me. Yeah.
It's the new thing.
So wait, so I don't want to scramble the direction of the story, yeah. But you're in Nashville.
Okay.
Let's go back to Nashville.
Okay,
acoustic guitar guy. No, don't be sorry.
No. And so we were talking about drums. And
Yeah.
And so being the kind of the odd man out, is luckily when we were doing the rehearsals for the stuff, the producer was a man named Jim Rooney, who I would go on the next project I did, I would co-produce the record with Jim Rooney. And so that's how I got started as a producer as well.
And was that on a label?
Yes. This stuff was on her record, I guess, was on, I guess she was on Rounder at that point, later on MCA, but I think that record was on Rounder. I can't remember what label we were on, but it was pretty much what I found incredible. It was that she was making her own magic happen. Her and her then boyfriend, who they weren't waiting for Warner Brothers to say you can make a record, and that's why everybody else in the world was.
Right.
And I thought it was, hey, you can't, you know. But they did get together a little deal with an indie, and also I didn't know anything about indie labels at that time. And they not only did that, but they made a record that has sold lots of copies and got around. But they did it on their own, and that's something that they should be proud of, and I was proud to be a part of it. But this Kenny Malone, they're setting me up, and again, I'm the odd guy out, and they set me on the far side of the room, which was a place called, it was Jack Clemens' studio in Nashville, a famous place. Mm-hmm. And I said, I want to, and this is something I had gotten from the Macon, Georgia guys. I noticed Tommy Talton taught me how to play rhythm guitar. He taught me a lot about it. About how important it is, how it's the glue, you know, just as important as the drums when you're laying down the track. Having that kind of seals it, the bass acoustic rhythm guitar. And he would talk to me about John Lennon, about how great he was. He said, you know, people don't think of John as a guitar player, but he would describe his strumming style.
Yeah.
And he's doing that on purpose, you know. And at the time I was kind of erratic, and he taught me how to make it full and steady, which is what you have to do when you're playing rhythm guitar in a recording session on a track. And this I said, will you move me to as close to the drummer as possible? And they were reluctant about it, but Kenny heard me say that. He said, yeah, move him over here. And they said, well, he's playing acoustic guitar. He's going to be right by the drums. But they had really good baffling. I said, well, we're recording live, aren't we?
Yeah.
And they said, yeah. Yeah. And I said, let's do it. And so he thought that was pretty cool, that this young kid, and mid-20s, I guess, at the time, would speak up and new guy. And after we did the very first session, he said, you're a real metaphysical player, aren't you? And I said, I hope so. And I thought that was an interesting word, metaphysical, about that. And he goes, yeah, man, and let's go downstairs and talk about time. And I went, wow, you know, it's like the rest of the guys there were kind of wearing the older Nashville guys. We were in polyester suits, smoking mm-hmm. Vincent and Hedges cigarettes, and just kind of a different vibe I was getting from them. And not of course Bella Fleck or Mark O'Connor, who both they came in and they were overdubbing their parts, I believe. Maybe Mark was there, and he had kind of a beatnik vibe for a Nashville guy, and it turned out he played on all the cool records made in Nashville, the George Jones and Dylan when he would come there, and he played with lots of people. But he goes and starts talking to me about drums and about nature, and saying drums, chime is everywhere, and it's in the street, and it's in the and it's in the when you go to the seashore. Time is in the way the tide rolls, and talking to me about all these things and making me aware of it. And he brought up a song called "Me and Mrs. Jones." Mm-hmm. You know the song?
Yeah, of course.
And he said that is one of the most grooving tunes in the world. He goes, you don't think of it as this, but it's the slowest song ever recorded. That I can, he goes, makes drown in my own tears seem like it's a upbeat.
You know? So,
and I said, yeah. He said, but you wouldn't think of that. And he said, you know why? And because it feels so good.
Yeah.
And he goes, when it happened, he wrote the drummer on the session, whom I can't remember his name, and said, I just want to tell you, it's one of the greatest records performances I've heard. And that's when it finally occurred to me that the drums make the feel of how all people will perceive that song. It will always feel good,
right?
And the history. And so at the end of the thing, before we had to go back and go to work, he kind of looked at me and said, "Energy isn't speed. Energy is time." And
wow.
And it was a thing that changed everything for me, because whenever I wanted to bring energy to a track, it was like, let's play it faster, and louder, and realize that, and it just taught me that little thing. And then he gave me, he goes, if you want to play, when you're playing rhythm guitar, he goes, find out which hand the drummer is keeping time with and don't listen to anything else. Yeah. And it's usually the right hand.
Right.
And it's usually on the hi-hat.
Yeah. That's usually too with your strumming.
And so all of a sudden, it changed everything for me. It made it easier for me to play that. But and so drummers, J.J. Johnson, Donnie Wynn, Tommy Taylor, Chris Searles, I feel really blessed in my lifetime to have worked with those guys.
And yeah, those are all
mainly people. Those guys.
Tommy's amazing.
Yeah, he's so beautiful. We've done this will be our 25th year doing the Number 9 Orchestra.
Jesus.
And, obviously, I don't think we could. We've had to do the show once or twice without him because he would be on tour or something like that.
Who was there when he was there?
David Murby, who mm-hmm. plays percussion with us.
Oh, now. Right. Yeah.
And David did a fantastic job. And David's he actually probably plays. We've been playing the songs the same way, like we might not be playing them the right way, but we've been playing them that way for 25 years.
We're not going to
change it. You know, we don't go, well, they're actually doing this. And going, really? Wow. Yeah. And then, you know, without Darren Murphy there to tell you.
Yeah.
That's one thing I really in my lifetime feel extraordinarily blessed to have played with drummers of that level.
And right.
And then moving on from the drums, the next big thing for me on this record was George Reith. I think his performance on my record, I couldn't dream of a better performance or a different person doing it. I bass, I've got to work with a person I work with a lot is Chris Marsh.
And I love him.
Chris, he's so versatile, and I do a lot of acoustic stuff, and he's able to. He's such an extraordinary upright bass player. If there's anything involved with that, he's way up there. The John Frimkin is another one who I haven't worked with much, but these two guys are world class upright bass players.
But having George, man.
I was making a decidedly pop record and trying to take all these things I'd done in my life. And ironically, I hadn't done a lot of things with George. I remember Will Sexton had brought him in on, you know, we did some shows and things like this, and I'd heard him. He always sounded great. But right before we did Arizona, I was doing a little EP with a band called These Fine Moments. And I said, well, this is, you know, I was trying to decide who I wanted to work with on my record, which would be a big thing in my life. And George came in, and so it was me and George and Donnie that did that that record. And so a nice, any fan of Arizona or hears it might want to find These Fine Moments and listen to that too, because they're playing on that's great too.
Yeah.
But when I went into the thing, I felt so. What I would tell anybody, if I had a $250,000 budget, this is who I would hire.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's not
yeah.
like I hired them because, oh, yeah. You know, they're around here.
There are also people that had $250,000 budgets and hired those guys. It's like you got you know.
Oh yeah, they are.
You
those
have
guys.
Access to really like the greatest guys. So this is your second solo album. Right.
Yeah, only the second. And
the first one, Rosebud, that was a. I mean, it was a big event when it came out, and it was a very. It was an anticipated album. It did well, and it really was a staple in, you know, people in my life's, you know, catalog.
It made me feel good.
Yeah, but this is all. I mean, it was a project that you kind of touched on this before. But let's go back. How did you meet James Honeyman Scott, and when was that? In like the late 70s or something?
No, yeah, it was the late 70s, or no, actually probably 1980. And that was an interesting story because I had got to some inroads with the people in Macon, and Capricorn Record was going under. I, of course, don't sound anything like Southern Rock. I was a big Nick Lowe fan. I just come from England. And I got taken to Muscle Shoals, and that's where I was going to perhaps do my record, because the people I was involved with management-wise, and they knew the Muscle Shoals people. Well, I idolized the Muscle Shoals people, and I saw them in Europe playing with Traffic.
Right.
And I also knew that Mark Knopfler and had gone down there and recorded, and Dylan, and you know, they didn't all do R&B type stuff. But when I went to go there, I remember talking just about the type of record I was going to make, and realizing that the kind of record that I had in my head was more of a pop record, and was it came to me at that point that this guy who I didn't know or have any connection to was James Honeyman Scott and the Pretenders. And I listened to their record. I said, the way that guy plays, I know what he's doing. I think that's the way I would like to sound and play. And so I brought that up, and they said, well, you don't know him, and that's not going to happen. I said, well, I'd like to ask him. And so rather than...
And that time there was no, like, Twitter or something to reach out, you know what I mean? Like, now maybe you could...
I could.
...find someone, like, get someone to write back. Yeah, yeah.
And what had happened was there was a gal that I knew, and her sister had married him.
All right.
I might have even known that at the time, but I certainly didn't think that was... literally about a week later, I was in Dallas, Texas, sitting backstage talking to James Honeyman Scott, and I gave him a tape, and it had several songs on it, one of which was kind of the cornerstone song called Jenny's Not Coming Home. And it was, at the time, that my management and my friends, the entourage, were demanding all his time and just wanting to get pictures with him, and they were giving him gifts and like and gave him a guitar. And I was, I just remember not saying much, saying hardly anything, and feeling kind of embarrassed and feeling, well, I'm very serious about this, and I don't want, you know, I didn't come here to get someone's autograph.
Yeah.
I remember leaving thinking it didn't go that great, that he was very polite to everybody, but I didn't get a chance to mean anything to him. And they were playing in Austin the next night, and I decided not to go. I was depressed. I was bummed out that I didn't get to, you know, have my shot to meet this guy that I had dreamed about meeting, and I did meet him, but it didn't work out well. And apparently on the airplane, Jenny, the wife of his, the sister of his wife, Peggy Sue.
Right. I worked with her at Whole Foods.
Jenny Fender.
Yeah.
And then her sister, Peggy Sue Fender. I mean, what a rock and roll name is that? Now her name is Peggy Sue Fender Honeyman Scott.
Jesus.
Pretty rock and roll name. And she, and part of it was that she was, went to the airplane and said, did you listen to that guy's tape? And he was like, what are you talking, you know, no. You know, the last thing on his mind was still that she goes, listen to his tape.
Yeah.
And made him listen to it, apparently. Or this is a story, so I heard. Or maybe he did on his own. But he listened to it on the airplane from Dallas to Austin. And when I'm sitting there, I got a call from Peggy, his wife. And at the time, I literally lived outside the front door of the Austin Opera House. If you were to walk out of the house and look to the left, that was, you'd see my car.
Right.
I lived there.
Yeah.
And I would play concerts there, and I did a lot of shows there because the promoter there would hire a band a lot to open for people, so we opened for a lot of people. And I would just walk with my guitar across the parking lot, walk on stage and play, and walk out and back to the apartment. And it was kind of unusual. And she said, Steve, where are you? And I said, I was really kind of, thought it went poorly last night, and I'm kind of bummed out about it. She goes, well, you might want to get over here, and because he listened to your tape, and he wants to meet you. And I said, okay. And so I walked across the 25 yards from my front door into the concert, and I walked in, and they were playing Message of Love. My favorite song, and his guitar playing on it. Sick. And I go back stage again, and sure enough, my entourage, my then manager and friends are there all having pictures taken with him, and the same thing as the night before. And I just, again, sat kind of in the corner.
Waiting for your turn.
And at one point, his wife topped on his shoulder and said, pointed at me, and he walked over and he said, Steve, he goes, I met you last night. And I said, yeah. And he goes, this is a, what do you have to do with this music on this tape? And those were his words, exactly. And I said, everything. I have everything to do with it. I wrote it and I performed it, and that's me playing and singing and stuff like that. And he goes, well, you know, it's really good. I really like it. And it's a, he goes, it's be the perfect thing for me because I'm going to try to spend a lot less time in England, and I married a girl from Texas, and what kind of deal do you have going? And we kind of had a production deal, not a big budget, but enough money, and we discussed the figures with him, and he said, yeah, we'll do it. And from that point, a new thing happened to me. I learned how to arrange music. I learned a lot of things from him. I would play a song on acoustic guitar, and he would listen, and then he would basically go around, stand in the middle of the room with the band surrounding him, and go to each instrument and ask them to play a part and sing it to them. And when the bass is going do 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 do, he go, no, don't do that. Go do 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 do. Stop 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 stop. Do 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 do. Don't stop stop stop. And then the guitar player stop. You know, play this. Ding da, da 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 da.
Yeah.
Da 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 da. And then 2, 3, 4. Boom. Do 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 do. And it was just unreal to me what a knack he had for arranging. So I realized I was right, that he all those great little parts and stuff that he had this. And it's very orchestral. And to find out, and people say, well, what is that music? That hard edged, almost punkish. Type of, you know, attitude that Chrissy was talking about, getting banged by bikers and stuff like that, and with their snarl and all this. And what does that have to do with the Beach Boys and stuff? Well, if you listen to his guitar, the voicings, it's the same. There's no difference in the beautiful voicings that that Brian Wilson would write for voices, he would write for guitars.
Right.
And so that's how I met him. And we would ended up working many, many hours together. the first group of recordings we did, we worked with this engineer who he ended up not liking because he made claims that Jimmy didn't think were true. And so we checked up on the guy, and the guy had not a great rap. And this is right before he went home and passed away. And we got offered a big deal from a major label, but this guy had put it together. And so I said, no, I want to work with Jimmy. And Jimmy doesn't want to work with you. And so it was kind of a weird thing at that point.
At that point, people
would give their arm for a major record deal.
But at that point, you were grooving so hard. You believed in what you were doing. There'd be another one.
Well, and we supposedly had to deal with a group out of Monument that had originally been Roy Orbison's label. And the head of A&R with them was saying, well, we're not going to be a country label. We're not going to be a Nashville label. This is going to be, and I was suspect of it, and I was right. Shortly after he died, they went bankrupt and wouldn't come back together again until...
And so they, owned your tapes? Or
no, they didn't. The production company... Okay. That I was working for that had it cut the deal. They were kind of in between, trying to probably make a. It was not a very solid situation to be in, and Jimmy said so. He said we could go to multiple places in L.A. and New York and get deals, but we were going to work it all out. And when we got the tapes back, they were erased. The guy had literally erased the tapes. Of the first four songs we had done, and they were the most, and it was really a sad thing. He said, "Don't worry about it. We were going to redo them anyway, without him." And look at them as demo tapes. And we went in to recorded a few more songs, mainly live, and they really had a lot better feel to them.
Yeah.
And, with just him, and he had. Said, well, I'm going to bring in somebody, a veteran. And he said, the only guy I really feel good about was this guy named Elliot Mazur. And Elliot had produced Harvest.
Right.
So next thing I know, guys like Elliot Mazur is coming to my house.
Right.
Ian Gibbons from the Kinks.
Wow.
Was coming to the house. And it was all looking like pretty sweet. And then he got a call, and I was with him saying, well, you got to come back. And he had been working on even though it's been said it was a tribute to him back on the Chain Gang, I've heard tapes of him playing that part that Billy Bremen plays on the record.
Okay,
I think Jimmy had a lot to do with the voices and of that song. I think that song was in the... ready to that was what they were he went back, but they had a guy in the band who was a amazing bass player. Like you would go see that band, the bass player and Jimmy were just off the chart. And if you hear the records, and they fired him. He got off the airplane and decided that Pete's drug addiction wasn't going to work. And so that's why when I heard the news, when someone walked in my bedroom and told me, I thought first that they were talking about someone else. I didn't realize they were talking about him. And and then as they were departing, he said, "Peg, didn't want you to hear it on the radio." And it hit me that it was him. And it just really, really gutted me. And I did make attempts to finish the record with Elliot Mazur. But the record company that we were with hated him and had a vendetta against him. And I'm going, the guy that did Harvest? I mean, are you kidding me?
Yeah, Jesus.
And so it became nasty. And so then I go up to New York and I play the tapes for some people at Capitol. And the woman said, I've been here for 2 years. I haven't signed anybody. I'm signing this. We're going to do it. And then by the time I get back to Austin, we have it all set up with the lawyer. She's been dismissed.
Right.
And, those type of things that happen all the time in life. And that's how I ended up going to Nashville. I just got tired of dealing with it and decided it was time to kind of take what I learned from Jimmy and carry it with me.
Yeah.
And move on down the road. And I'd get back to being a solo artist. And little did I know it would be
a long time.
A long time, about 15 years before I would put out Rosebud.
Right. But I love Arizona.
Thank you.
Did a really wonderful job.
Thanks.
And you did it in your own place this time, huh?
Yeah, we did. That was one of the things, is, you know, having a place, and, you know, people talk about having a recording studio or being a part owner. It's like the joke is, well, you know, you'll never make a record again.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because to keep it going, you know, you have bills to pay, and I've spent a lot of my I looked up one day, and all of a sudden I had been a producer of something like 60 independent records.
Wow.
And not counting a bunch of TV stuff, and all just, you know, mainly Austin artists and things like that. And I'd done some songwriting with some different people. I'd had it seems like every year something would happen. A song would get placed somewhere, or around the time I started working with James Stevens was the same time I started writing with for the Double Trouble record with Chris Layton and Tommy, and they had always wanted to do. They had performed a song I wrote with Malford Milligan with Storyville, and would close her shows with it. And I knew Stevie very well, but I didn't know them. And Chris Layton was asking me about this song I wrote, and he said, "Well, it has two meanings," he would always say, and I said, "Yeah, it does." And I didn't really know the song. I wrote the song for that. It seems like the only songs that ever get recorded are when I'm writing them for a project. You know, the idea of writing a song for myself rarely does it get recorded. I mean, my songs are a little, you know, the changes and all that. They're not the most easy songs to learn, I don't think, maybe. But the just the way they come out, it's more orchestral for me. But the during that period of time, I was doing a lot of producing and writing. And working with Chris and Tommy was a great experience, because it allowed me to write some things I normally wouldn't have written.
Yeah.
There's a song on the record called "Baby, There's No One Like You," and it's almost like a jazz ballad or something, but it would end up being recorded by Dr. John with Willie Nelson.
Yeah, when was that? Didn't you record like a demo of that at my house?
I think maybe I did the demo at your house. That's very possible.
Yeah.
It's a funny story about the demo, because the way they worked, they would we'd write a song. And we wrote a bunch of them. And one of the big centerpiece song was their opening song called "Cry Sky," which most people would, and I really like the song. It's very Hendrix-y. And I think people would relate it to their statement about, to their friend and band, Stevie. And the first time I met him, as usual, we didn't sit around playing instruments. We just spoke, and we talked about that. We talked about loss and of people close to us and all that. And they had the idea for "Cry Sky" in the first verse, written on a piece of paper. And I went home, and by the time I'd gotten home, I'd heard this song in my head, and went back, and we completed that song and continued. But how they would do that at that point, they would go in, and Charlie Sexton produced a lot of that record and did a great job. But they'd go in with Malford and have him sing the music. And even though they had just previously had broken up with their Storyville band, they were very close with Malford still. And he would do a demo of it. Yeah. And so when I played a gig somewhere with Will Sexton, and I played that song, and he goes, at the end of it, he goes, "Whose song is that?" And I said, "Well, I just wrote it." He said, "Man, you know who has to sing that, don't you?" And I said, "I think they're going to pitch it to so-and-so or whatever, you know, that they think is going to be on their record." It was a well-known blues singer. And he goes, "Man, you know who has to do it?" And I said, "Who?" And he goes, "Dr. John." And he starts singing it, and Dr. John, everyone does their "But you better hurry up and know it," you know, doing their impression of Dr. John. And I go, "You're absolutely right." Yeah, I mean, I'm written for him. And so I get a call from Chris Layton early in the morning but one day, and he goes, "Hey, man, we're in New Orleans, and we're in the airport, and Dr. John's coming back to Austin. He's going to record on the record. That's, you know, that one song you wrote, could you change it and make it a little bit more like, you know, Fittler style? The way you have it is more..." And he was absolutely dead on. It was written real country blues, which is not really what their thing is.
Right.
They're more, you know, blues rock type of a thing. And I said, "Yeah, I understand what you mean." I said, "But, you know, you got to play in the ballad." And he goes, "Well, we never demoed that." And I said, "Yeah, you do. You have that little cassette." And he goes, "Yeah, I do. I have it in my... and my thing, and I think I might, you might have recorded,
oh, wow.
In fact, I think you, I know you recorded,
oh, I remember, and when I heard the song, even like when I got the record, like in November or whatever, I know this song, I couldn't remember, but then when I remembered that it was for Dr. John or something like that.
Well, it was a me alone on acoustic guitar, and I remember distinctly coming and recording, and there was another thing, it looked like Jimmy Cliff was recording a song I'd written.
Wow.
And so it could have been that one, but now when I think about it, I did that at Courtney Dane's house. So it was probably that song, and so the... wow, there you go.
Yeah.
And so he said, "Well, I had that demo of you just doing it." And so far in my life, that's the way I feel about songs. If they don't stand up with you playing them, you know, you probably set up one microphone, I probably sang it. You know, we didn't sit there and bring in a...
Not at all. I remember that day.
Yeah, and it was a...
You were like in my kitchen.
Yeah.
We unplugged the refrigerator.
Exactly. Yeah. We unplugged the refrigerator and cut them off. And so I'm with him. And I call him back with the changes to the other song, and they're still at the airport, and he goes... Or at that point, they're at the airport earlier. They were leaving the hotel. And I told him the changes to the song, and he goes, "Man, you just wrote, you know, changed that. It was great. That's really exactly what I was talking about." And I said, "Well, good, man. Thanks. You know, your collaborator here on the ball." He said, "You like it a lot better, don't you?" And I said, no, I like it better the other way. But I get what you mean and all this." And I said, "Did you play in the ballot? Did you play in the ballot?" I kept saying it over and over.
Yeah.
And he goes, finally goes, "Yeah, I did." And he goes, "I think he likes it." And I said, "What do you mean you think he likes it?" And he goes, "Well, I'm sitting next to him in the airport right now, and he's talking softly." And he goes, he pushes play, and then about 3.5 minutes later, he pushes rewind and plays it again. He's done that about 10 times.
Oh, wow.
And we'll call you when we get to Austin. And so I'll give you a ring about 1 or 2. And I go, "Okay, great, man. I'm all excited. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I go, "I blew it. I should have just, you know, instead of pushing my dream thing and letting Will's planting the seed in my brain, you know, about who needs to record the song." And I get a call around 8:00, and it's from Tommy Shannon. He's going, "Steve, what's that chord you're playing? And blah, 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 because it has a billion, it's more like a jazz song. You know, it's got a lot of changes." And I said, "What are you talking about?" He goes, "Well, we're cutting the song." And I said, "Well, nobody told me."
Yeah.
And so I was over there so fast because it was on they called it Brooklyn Bridge at the time.
And then
Stuart took it over after that. But it was right around the corner from my house. And I was there so quickly. Chris Layton laughed. He said, "What were you
standing outside?
Standing out in the parking lot?" And I didn't. I said, no, but I'm here." And I walked in, and I could hear him playing the song on piano. And it was a big thing for me because he's such a... I had a poster of him when I was 12 years old on my wall. My family's from New Orleans, and one side of my family. And he said something. What went down was another thing I'll never forget. He said, "Where's that songwriting motherfucker? Tell him to get his ass in here." He goes, "Tommy, this is the smartest thing you've done all day. How come this motherfucker wasn't here when I showed up? He knows how the motherfucker goes. He wrote it." And he said that, and I'm going, "Well, first off, yeah. How come I wasn't here?"
Yeah.
And then I walk up to him, and he looks at me. He goes, "Where are you from?" I said, well, I was born in Texas. He goes, that's not it. Where's your daddy from? And I said, he's from a little town in Georgia. And he goes, that's not it. And before I could say anything, I said, my mom's from a little town called Hahnville. It's just up the river from me. He goes, I knew it. I knew it. When I heard your song, I knew it. When I saw you, I was positive. His mama's from New Orleans, and that's why I'm going to cut this motherfucker.
That's awesome.
He saw me, heard a song, knew where my mother was born.
Yeah.
So, and then Charlie had the great idea of, well, you know, obviously Charlie could have played a brilliant solo with Denny Freeman, but they decided that it might be a good idea to invite someone of one of Mac's peers, and they asked Willie Nelson to play be the soloist on the cut.
Shit.
And so at first his manager said no, but this kid that on the session, or a kid who had gotten a hold of the demo of it, this demo got around and played it and he ends up I get a call from Chris Layton saying, I just got a call from Willie Nelson. I thought that they were probably old friends, but they had never worked together, and Charlie had never worked with them. So when we worked with Willie, it was a pretty heavy thing. And so it's like all these years of things not happening. You know, this person dies right before the Jimmy Cliff story, how that came so close to happening, but his manager screwed it up. And you know, that happens a lot in throughout your life. And so I don't count on anything.
No.
You just go from day to day. And it leads to where you are now. And where I am now was the Arizona thing. I got a note from a good friend of mine in radio. I was one of the first people I mailed a record to, and wrote me back. He said, man, great record. It seems like everything you've done for 35-plus years has led to this record.
Yeah.
And that's the way I see it.
Yeah.
Is that you know, you can't help it but learn a few things. A lot of the things I loved about I'd also done a record with Will Sexton, mm-hmm. and made a very fine record with Bill Carter and Will Sexton. And both records didn't it was too difficult to coordinate
touring and
And just you know, you get one guy that's not as into it as the other two or whatever.
Sure.
It's next thing you know, it was never intended to be, we're going to be a band and conquer the world. We were just making music. This record, I wanted to be just my vision of the record I wanted to make. I thought about it a lot.
Yeah.
And it's funny to me, I was rehearsing the parts with James Stevens, my partner at Ear, who didn't play on the record. He recorded it, and so he knows it better than most people. And while we were doing it, I was really having a good time.
Yeah.
I was going, hey, that's, you know, I did this.
Yeah.
Good, cool.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you don't sit there and of any record, I actually listened to the album as a fan.
Good.
A fan of it. You know,
yeah.
I'm and I go, the fact that I'm involved in it and it's me or whatever, I'm not one to do that very often. I find it pretty painful lots of times listening to things I do and go, great idea.
It
was nice what you were going for, but you didn't really get there, did you? And I thought James Podolnik, who produced Rosebud, did a fantastic job. I thought his sound and production on it were really wonderful. But this was something that after doing 50 or 60 records, I had to do this.
Yeah,
I
you have to.
I knew when I almost every note I wanted to hear and every spot, and it was very important to me to you know, just for the sake of the music.
Yeah, and people can find it on the iTunes. It's on Spotify. You can go to thestephendoster.com, get it there. Also, Rosebud is available there.
Yes.
You can get if you don't have Rosebud, get it, because that's a great album, too.
Yeah, Waterloo Records,
Waterloo,
too.
Waterloo Physical Records, if you live in Austin.
If you live in Austin, Texas, you can go down there and get it. But we're working on distribution for it, because it's all a brand new day for me. on the February 14th, and here it is the 2nd of February. Even though the record was made available at the end of 2014, I was in Europe that whole time.
Right, touring and supporting it.
Yeah, support of the record. And this will be the first show I do in support of the record.
And that's February 14th, 2015 at Strange Brew, right?
Yes. That's correct. February 14th, 2015 at 9:30. And the band is Donnie Wynn on drums, George Reef on bass, Brian Standifer.
Oh, yeah. Long time. Show.
And he was my alumni from Rosebud.
Yeah.
And James Stevens, my partner on the making of Arizona, will be playing guitar and singing. And Dave Madden will be playing piano.
Yeah.
And I'm very excited about it. I'm probably going to spend the rest of the year working.
The record?
The record. I had a blessing happen in my life with this record. The other thing, I don't think I could have made this record also had it not been for Atticus Records.
Right.
It's a big difference. It's very difficult. It's a do-it-yourself world. Mm-hmm. But to have some people that believe in the record and
in your corner.
And your corner, it just makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, I just talked to them this morning before I came here, and there's too much for us to do, we can just do what we can every day. It's like, who's going to pick up the posters? Who's going to order the posters? Who's going to, but it's a good problem to have.
Yeah.
What I didn't know, was how it would be perceived. And, I was touring with Bob, and sometimes we stayed in this hotel. That's really using the term
loosely.
It was the most horrible place on the planet, and I still haven't got to write my negative review. I'm going to
on Yelp
and it's going to start with whatever you do.
Yeah.
You can call me if you're too broke and you have to stay here and you need a little extra money.
Yeah.
I'll give you the money to go somewhere else. It was the most horrible place in the world to stay. And I think it was maybe that next morning I got my first email saying a review came out in the Austin Chronicle or the American Statesman. I'm not sure which one was first. It was pretty much within a couple of days of one another. And they're really heartening. And something profound happened. And then the reviews from several places around the country. Guitar World, right before I left, had streamed one of the songs to millions of people. So I was getting responses from, I was surprised how it worked. That people, they wrote a very nice article in their magazine, and that made me feel good that Guitar World would talk about me because I'm a guitarist.
Yeah, of course.
And I'm maybe an anti-flash guitarist, but it was a great thing, and it was the profound thing that happened to me as I realized that there are people that are listening. There are some people that listen, and I think it's very difficult to get people to listen to. And we're in a weird day and age where I hear a lot of it's hard to know the more serious records from there's just so many of them.
Yeah, so much. It's all coming at you at once.
And people, and it's not anybody's fault, you know. It's like, why should anyone listen to me, you know?
Yeah.
Something has to happen in it. And, you know, either they hear about it from someone. And that's all I've really, that's what I go by in music now, is that
someone cool tells you something's cool, you get it.
In my own case, is that all I can hope for is that someone will listen to it. If they'll listen to it, I think we have a pretty good chance. They might like it.
Yeah.
It's
a great album.
I think that there's some things on it that I always had wanted to kind of put together that we did. And I'm really happy with it. I enjoy the songs, but it's you know, getting people to, driving people, you know, to the actually physically holding it in their hand and listening to it. It's a whole new game. And so yeah. I think you have to be a very and this is what I like about Atticus, a very realizing that, you know, we're not going to, you know, sell a million copies of this. You know, we have to sell them one by one. Mm-hmm. And we have to figure out different ways. One of the weird ways is, I think television and film, we're going to really try to see if we can play songs in that manner, which I have in the past. I've had quite a few songs. I did a little deal with Universal a few years ago, and songs popped up all over the place. But they were just little ditties, and not real songs like on the record. They were just ideas.
Yeah, you got to do what you can to get it out there. I mean, that's the time that we live in, and it's extremely different than, you know, even when you put out Rosebud, just the climate of what's going on.
Yeah, there's more radio stations then.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know what to... I feel, and I don't mean this in a discouraging way, I'm getting ready to work with two young artists as a producer. And my goal in that thing will be what it always is to try to make them make the best record they possibly can, and to help them and give them everything I got, give them every idea I have, and make it. But I do find myself thinking I'm kind of glad I'm not beginning.
Fuck yeah, me too.
And then I'm kind of at the other. I'm not at the end of my life or anything.
Yeah.
But at this point, I'm okay. I somehow managed to make it to this chair right here, and I have a beautiful wife and a beautiful home and a wonderful son.
Yeah.
And my life has been blessed in that manner. And at the very worst, I can throw a guitar over my shoulder and go and sing for people about any night of the week, you know. And I've been lucky, and I have.
Yeah, you have.
And this year, ironically, when I'm going to be concentrating on this record, I'll probably play the least amount of live performances because if it's not a performance geared toward the record, I'm not that interested in it. As opposed to, there were times when Will and Bill and Carter, we would play five nights a week in Austin.
Yeah.
And the thing was, I had a recording studio that and I was producing a lot, and I just wasn't on the road a lot.
Yeah.
I see in my future I'll probably be touring a lot more and hitting, going out and doing brief bits. But, you know, it'll be as many as I can.
I mean,
obviously, there's if you're losing money on them,
you got to cool it down.
Yeah, cool it out.
Well, if anyone's listening from anywhere, you can go find out where Stephen will be playing at stephendoster.com. You can get the album there. You can also go to iTunes. You'll find it on Spotify. But if you live in Austin, Saturday, February 14th?
Saturday,
February 14th, Valentine's Day. Take your loved one to see Stephen Doster and his amazing band at the at the Strange Brew.
Yes. And we'll be on Jody Denberg's KUTX in Studio 1A at 2 o'clock the day before.
Okay, on Friday.
Yeah.
The 13th.
Friday.
Fantastic.
The 13th.
Is there anything I'm missing? It's good to catch up with you.
Yeah, man. It's so beautiful to see you. Well, I think we could probably do this for more hours than you'd like to.
We have, too. Yeah. It's too bad that I didn't have this recorder with me. I could have just put out a whole thing of just...
Yeah,
times that we've. I love you, and I'm very,
too,
I'm very, very, very happy with your record. I think I wrote you when I got it.
Yeah,
when I saw that it came out.
And,
stuff.
And that's what I mean. If there's anyone listening to this, is that it doesn't matter. It's just if you can touch one person. I had a friend of mine write me in the hospital, and they literally said at their darkest time, they got this record and it. I don't want to go to get too overly maudlin about it, but it was very touching to me to know that. And things like that have happened in my life before where a song, it's just in the right song in the right time and right place. And that's all you can hope for. Making a living doing it is a real bonus. And I feel very lucky that to be have 40 years behind me and not have 40 years ahead of me to have to be thinking about that. But it's going to, from now on, I can pretty much just dedicate myself to try to have integrity in the things I, with the new music. I've cleaned the shelves off a little bit where I can write some new songs. That's one thing. I had to make this record just to get it out of my
get
system.
Get some room, to get
some room in my brain.
Well, man, people be looking forward to it. Get out to Strange Brew Lounge Saturday, February 14th, 2015, 9:30. Stephen Doster and the amazing band performing Arizona. Thanks, man. Stephen Doster, fantastic dude, man. I love him. Get out to stephendoster.com and find out how you can pick up a physical copy of Arizona, or you can go and get it on iTunes. Of course, it is on Spotify as well. Stephen Doster, you can also pick up his old album, Rosebud. Get out on Saturday, February 14th, if you are in Austin, Texas, 9:30 at Strange Brew. He will be performing. I love this guy, Stephen Doster. His body of work is fantastic. His production is fantastic. As I said, I got to make an album with him once with Stephanie Fix. Always a great experience with Stephen. I love him. Okay? While you're out there checking out Stephen Doster stuff, don't forget that you can like our Facebook page. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, and you can find us on Stitcher. And if you really want to get into it, you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter. I'm at Johnny Gowdy on Twitter and Instagram. All right? Let's hear some more music from Stephen Doster's brilliant album, Arizona. All right? Get out there Saturday, February 14th, Valentine's Day. Take your love, man, lady, whatever it is that you're with, take them. And show them a good time and support Stephen Doster. He's a great artist. Let's hear some more music from him. Let's get down.
All the houses on my street turning to rubble. Future is now, can only mean trouble. She saw a white horse running in an open field. My eyes on the horizon, hands upon the wheel, place in the sun. Cars begin to thin, but further out I drive. But for the shape I'm in, this notion is alive. Place in the sun, where the mockingbird sings, right in the tide. Sun, where the mockingbird sings.